Hey everybody, before you listen to today's podcast, A, I hope everybody is doing well. I know this has been quite the year. And two, make sure, like right now, like stop and make sure, write this down, 212-931-5731. So much of getting the first mover advantage in my world, or to just get a random text that makes you feel better. I've been blown away by the random text to make you feel better, what that's meant to tens of thousands of you and how that's impacted your day. So if you want a smile or if you want an advantage, check me out on my text platform, 212-931-5731. Text it and follow the directions that I reply to you with. And I appreciate for all of you that have been on the community platform with me. And here is your podcast.
This is the Gary V Audio Experience.
Hi everyone, thanks for joining us this afternoon. We're delighted to be hosting Gary Vaynerchuk for the next hour. We will be having Q&A at the end, so please make sure you get your questions in the right-hand corner so we can get to them. So this guy needs no introduction. Gary is the chairman of VaynerX, the active CEO of VaynerMedia, CEO of VaynerSports, serial entrepreneur, prolific angel investor, and 5 times New York bestseller. So welcome, Gary.
Thank you so much, Emma. How are you?
I'm good. How are you keeping?
I'm keeping. It's been, I think all of us will very much struggle to ever forget 2020. And I'm really excited to be here. I just want to say hello to everybody on the LinkedIn side, a platform I'm extremely fond of, and I've had the luxury of doing events in America and other parts, and big special shout out to Niall, who worked with me at Vayner for many, many, many years, who I know is having a fantastic career on LinkedIn. And I've not been doing a whole lot of these because I've been really in operations mode, but when he asked, I knew I had to say yes. So I'm really glad to be here with you.
Oh, it's great. Thanks so much. And I know we've loads of LinkedIn attendees who are so excited to get your insight and perspective on the industry. So, We'll dive in with some questions, but the first thing I have to ask you in true LinkedIn style, and it wouldn't be a LinkedIn event without it, is can you tell us what's not on your LinkedIn profile?
What's not on my LinkedIn? So, you know, when you're a prolific entrepreneur, you end up forgetting some of the things you're even doing. So I've had, for example, what's not on my LinkedIn profile, in the last 36 months, I've had 2 companies that I've co-founded or founded, Empathy Wines, which was a direct-to-consumer wine brand, and Resy, which was a restaurant app POS system for the restaurants, and on the consumer side, demand side, have substantial exits. Resy sold for hefty 9 figures to Amex. And Empathy, I just sold about a month and a half ago to Constellation Brands, the biggest wine company in the world, for almost $100 million exit. And neither of those 2 substantial business wins are on my LinkedIn profile. So I would say probably, you know, a lot of times when people see me, they think of me as a motivational speaker, as a content creator. And a lot of times, if I'm being very transparent, you know, a part of me is upset by that because I have so much pride in the fact that, you know, between building my dad's business, building Vayner, Resy, Empathy, my angel investments, I have a substantial actual career that's overshadowed by my prolific content creation. And sometimes that's my own fault in doing, because here I have these big business wins and I'm not even listing them on my LinkedIn account. So as soon as I'm hang up here, I'm going to get to work and make sure it gets updated.
You should. They're amazing achievements. And you talk about that, your personal brand. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You've been a pioneer in the practice of building a personal brand. How do you feel it's contributed to your success?
You know, when you put yourself out there as a human being, you're there's no question to me that there's an incredible amount of benefits. You know, I started an advertising agency 11 years ago, and really 9 years ago, because the first 2 years I was quite passive. My younger brother really held it down because I was still running my dad's business. And it was actually what really threw me off was I wrote my first book, Crush It, and that became a New York Times bestseller and a big one. And that kind of got me, you know, pulled into speaking and other things, and I wanted to take advantage of that. So, but I started this business coming from being a wine merchant in New Jersey. So it was really my personal brand the book, the speeches, the content, that even gave us a chance to have those first conversations with a Pepsi, with a Campbell's, with a GE. And it was built on that back, because otherwise there was no knowledge, there was no rationale for the biggest companies in the world to take a meeting with us, started by a wine merchant and a kid that came out of college. So it's contributed in the start of Vayner for sure, media. It's contributed in the fact that Mark Zuckerberg allowed me to invest in his company because of my personal brand, you know, not because of anything else. I was just a wine merchant, and now Twitter and Facebook and Tumblr, David Karp, you know, Blaine Cook at Twitter, these humans were interested in me because of the content I was putting out on the internet, and it became the gateway, the ticket to let me into different places in my life. So it's been a huge door opener. People, you're on the in, when you put out content to the world, what happens next is people reach out to you. So, you know, whether it's Dwayne the Rock Johnson or whether it's Johnson and Johnson, I have had people reach out to me instead of me having to reach out to them, because I've created brand. And that's been incredibly powerful to my career. The downside is you have to live and die by your personality. So I am a scrappy immigrant kid that grew up in middle-class New Jersey. And so that has meant that my content has cursing in it, which, you know, so I've just told you some nice things. I know for fact that we were on the verge of getting a multi-million dollar contract from a Fortune 50 company, and a board member saw LinkedIn, actually this is funny to tell you guys, saw a LinkedIn video where I was crass in my language, not in what I was talking about, and literally sent an email to the CEO, which the CEO then sent an email to the division leader, that basically eliminated our agency from being able to do work because she was unhappy with that. And I'm competitive, and I'm an over the top personality. So there's definitely been some losses along the way, but you kind of live your life in knowing that there's some pluses and minuses to it. You know, when you put yourself out there, you've allowed people to make judgment of you. And though 98% of the comments on every LinkedIn post that I put out are incredibly positive, there's no question that there's 2% of, well, this guy's a charlatan, he actually doesn't know anything. And you know, when you're a human being, no matter how thick your skin is, no matter how much success you have, it never feels nice to have somebody call you names or degrade you. And so, you know, it's a process that is not for everyone, but I do believe net has more positive than negative impacts.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Emma, the reason it's interesting, and I appreciate you kind of the way that processed for you, and I hope for the people that are watching, is it's the reason most people don't do it, Emma. The reason most people don't put out content, like to me, again, you know what's fun about living my life? I put out all my content all the time. So I think everybody here knows that I'm not pandering to the LinkedIn audience right now. I have been an incredibly big advocate about LinkedIn content for the last 5 years. It's a game changer for people's professional careers. LinkedIn's organic reach is remarkable, best in the world, along with TikTok, meaning anybody here, Gavin, you, Jennifer Shaw Sweet, Christopher Glenn, anybody here tomorrow can make their first video on their LinkedIn account about something maybe different and start the process of having more people know about them. But the reason most people don't is they can't deal with the negative pushback. And that is unfortunate. And that's why I've spent a lot of time with my content talking about self-esteem and self-worth and self-love and patience and all the things that are needed and required to actually have a chance to be successful at content creation. It's much more of a mental game than it is a creative, what do I post? It's, can I deal with the ramifications of posting?
Of course, yeah. You talk about how you're using LinkedIn now. Like, how have you seen LinkedIn evolve as a platform, and how are you using it now versus, say, a couple of years ago, and potentially how are your teams using it as well for business development?
You know, I don't know. I would argue, and I give Facebook an incredible amount of credit for their evolution over the last 15 years, but I would still say that out of all the platforms in the world, the one that has gone through the most significant transformation is LinkedIn. Here's why. It started off truly as a utility. There was no part of LinkedIn 7 years ago that made people think content creation, social. I mean, people refer to LinkedIn as a social network now in certain pockets of the industry. So, you know, 6 years ago, I could go an entire year without going to my LinkedIn because I was an entrepreneur. I wasn't looking for jobs, and, you know, the end, pretty much. Now, I would argue that when I have a business objective, it's the first place I think about. And so, you know, it's also evolved into VaynerMedia. We produce an enormous amount of broad content with other CMOs, not even our own clients. We're doing something called Marketing for the Now right now, which is a 2-hour free seminar once every 10 days, where we interview a bunch of the thought leaders in the business world. And I would argue that 50% of the reason we do it is just to give us post-production creative for our VaynerMedia LinkedIn, because that brings awareness from other marketers about our agency. And so it has become a massive force. It is also a big part of our playbook as an agency provider. We have become very aggressive going after B2B clients, because we think instead of doing print ads in the B2B magazine or buying $1 million booths at conferences, that LinkedIn content strategy is the single best strategy for every B2B marketer. And now, even scarier, last night I was talking to a food CPG company, and during the meeting I said, look, I think LinkedIn is something you need to think about. I think LinkedIn is acting like Facebook did 7 years ago, and I know how you're thinking about it, senior marketer who's not in the trenches. But I would tell you that if you put out recipe content on LinkedIn right now, it will do extremely well. And you should be looking at this platform a different way. And so I think people are starting to kind of quote unquote get it, that there's something really going on here.
You talk about this Marketing for Now initiative that you're running. How do you see, like, with everything that's happened this year and the pandemic, how do you see recovery taking shape for marketeers? How do you see them coming out of this? What's your perspective on it?
My perspective is that the global economy is in much worse shape than anyone's really talking about, because everyone's printed money. You know, we've got a lot of conflict. You've got nuances of nationalism sprinting everywhere around the world, led by America and China. And I think, you know, I would argue that, first of all, I have no clue, because we're not out of it, right? You know, what's really difficult about that question, and when I'm asked it, is, look, first, you know, geopolitical and global economic variables have to play out, and that's a little bit above my pay grade. You know, I haven't done that homework, but what I can tell you is it's very clear to me that the common sense fundamentals are in a very vulnerable spot, and you have a major election in the U.S., and you have some pretty aggressive things going around the world. You have conflict in my former, you know, birthplace of Belarus, where they're trying to overthrow a dictator. You've got real stuff going on. And so I think that people are a little naive in thinking, well, I think the world has had a very good run. You know, if you think about it economically, outside of the recession, the global recession of 2008, the reality is that the world has had a fairly good run economically over the last 40 years. And I think that has made us very soft and very naive to what could happen. Now, I'm not predicting doomsday or depressions or great recessions, but I will say that we are so far away from understanding recovery, because recovery is a fascinating thing. This is not like a war or a recession where you've already understood the dynamics. One could argue that you will never see human beings again at an airport not wearing a mask. Let's just say that's true, Emma. If that's true, just on that, just on everything went back to normal, except when every human travels, they wear masks. Just that heavily impacts a lot of businesses. travel, the food and beverage businesses that rely on, you know, the ecosystems of global airports. You know, there's just a duty-free shop. Like, there's just that. And by the way, all of us know that that's not the case. There'll be many, many more ramifications of this. And so, not to mention something that I don't think people remember about, you know, in America, I talk to a lot of executives about, remember 9/11? It was devastating. And then for the next 5 years, anytime anything happened with a plane or this, you were gun shy. I mean, I expect every human being for the next 5 years to overreact to another human being sneezing in any situation. What does that mean? Think about that. Does that mean that events and restaurants have a 3% decline? Let's just say 3%, Emma. You know, restaurants work on such low margin that if they just lose 3 to 5% of their business, because the most extreme of us are scared post-corona and really kind of just don't leave the house anymore, period. Or far less often, if you were somebody who went out to eat 28 times a year, you're down to 3. If that's the case, for some businesses, they can't recover with that 5% loss. That was all their profit. And so I think the ramifications are substantial. On the flip side, there's a lot of businesses that will explode. Every direct-to-consumer business on the internet is going to grow with that transition. So I think there's still a lot unknown. As a matter of fact, this morning, back to, you know, the UK market, you know, this morning I woke up to Boris Johnson saying that they're going to take the groups, that gatherings down from 30 to 6. That's a step backwards to recovery, right? That doesn't mean, you know, and I think that this is going to go on for a little while. And I don't think most people realize that it's going to be next summer, if everything goes remarkably well, to where you kind of might start seeing the first toe in the water back to normalcy. That's a long time. That's not, I remember when this all happened, I thought, oh my God, we're going to close the offices for 2 weeks. That's crazy. It's going to end up being closer to 2 years than 2 weeks. So I think it's unprecedented times. And I think it's way early to figure out what happens. But what I can tell you is, for me, and this is just, I would call this luck. For me, the fact that everything in my mind has been about video streaming and the cell phone and, you know, lack of friction, internet only, the real world is secondary, nice, important, but it's secondary to this world. You know, that has put me in a position as a communicator and as a business operator in a better spot than some businesses, because I bet on the internet, and the internet is the real winner of this, you know, of this reality. I mean, I would very likely be doing this in person with you, Emma, the next time I was in the region. Now I'll be able to do it 3 times with you, and I'm sitting in my apartment right now. And so, you know, I mean, I can tell you right now, I think it takes generations for the airline and travel industry to recover from this, because even when everybody in 5 years is back to normal, I'm still going to debate, do I need to go to San Francisco today for this meeting, or can I do this on Zoom or Hangouts or BlueJeans? And the answer 6 out of 10 times is I can do it on BlueJeans.
And it is, I mean, it's the changes that are going to happen for all these industries you name. So some are going to explode and some are going to be devastated for years to come. I guess it's, you know, as salespeople ourselves, what kind of advice would you have for us approaching these marketeers, these CMOs or CEOs, whether they're of advertising agencies like yourselves or if they're direct with clients? What advice would you give us?
Let me go very narrow with this answer. Let's make pretend the pandemic didn't even happen. I would tell everybody here to have more pride in the product you're selling. You know, I have the unfortunate thing where I get to do fireside chats with companies that I think are going through challenges. And because I'm, you know, this is being recorded, I want to be historically correct. So I'm a nice person, but I don't want to say something I don't believe. So sometimes when that question's asked, I get into, hey, can I speak to the engineers and the product people? Because your product's not very good right now. And who cares if you're a good salesman? You're not going to have good lifetime value. I think I have the great fortune to have the reverse conversation right now with everybody on this call. I would tell you the number one thing that I would tell everybody here is to have way more pride in what you're selling. I know, because I'm very close to the world, that most brands, B2B included, have not accepted the incredible power that LinkedIn is as a content and marketing engine. It is everyone's job on this call to actually break through to agencies and to brands. And I think that most of you will be too passive. I think you need to go in with way more conviction, way more audacity, because you actually do have one of the best tools in marketing at your fingertips. And I know the world doesn't know it. So you need to cross all your T's and I's with the examples. But most of all, you need to go into those rooms on the borderline of audacious, because you're selling one of the best products. And I know that's not the tone and tenor, because what happens is when something's not accepted by the world, most salespeople come in too passive. And my career has been, when I know I have the right thing, when it's right for the customer, then if I'm going to somebody in between the humans that use it and the customer, and like if there's a decision maker, AKA the CEO of Wieden and Kennedy or the CMO of Cadbury, if that person's in between that company doing it with LinkedIn and the people that actually consume it, the actual people in the feed of LinkedIn, well, and I know LinkedIn is right, well, I'm being very aggressive in my conviction. I'm very convicted. And I think clients and agencies need to hear that from a salesperson, because if they're skeptical and you come in too passive, you're too far away now to move them. And so as a salesperson, I've only sold things I believe in, because I don't know how to be a salesperson when I don't, because it requires too much conviction to get somebody on board. Listen, this is a real pleasure and joy for me. I hope everybody on this call really realizes how strong the product is right now. The organic reach is remarkable, and the targeting is remarkable, because it's not replicated anywhere else in the world. I cannot get to that many business decision makers all with the same title on their job description anywhere else in the world. That is the ultimate weapon. And the same way that it took Facebook a half a decade to get its feet under them to really go out there and get the dollars, I think that I'm hoping for your sake, I mean, to me, in a weird way, to me, the longer people don't know that LinkedIn is this strong is better for Vayner and me, because I'm picking up more organic reach. But for the context of what I was invited to speak here, this is a rare opportunity for me to flex on your behalf. This is a very great era for LinkedIn marketing, and I hope that you're communicating that to your clients.
Great to hear that. Thank you for that feedback. You were talking there about organic reach, and you talk quite a bit about underpriced attention. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me a little bit what you mean by underpriced attention and how can LinkedIn lean into that?
Oh, underpriced attention, I've come to realize, is really my religion. I built my dad's business from a $3.8 million business to a $65 million business in 7 years, and I had no money. And the reason I was able to do that was three things. One, I realized that having a website was going to be important. So I built a website, and that alone was a big deal. This is 1996. Number two, a year later, I realized email was a big deal. And this was the great gift of my career. Email ended up being a killer app for selling stuff, and it was free. So my competitors were printing catalogs with wine in it and shipping it, which cost them a lot of money to make the catalog and a lot of money in postage. I was gathering people's emails every time they came into the store. I literally, Emma, would not let somebody leave my dad's store without giving me their email. And I think you can tell my tenacity, and I was a youngster, I was real hungry then. So, and through that, two things happened. I was faster and it cost me less. I was faster because when Opus One or Chateau Lafite or Dom Perignon's new vintage came out, I would email it the day it came in and I would get the sale. A month later, those individuals would get the catalog from my competitors saying the new Dom Perignon's here. So I was winning on speed, but also cost. And then finally, the tipping point was Google AdWords. I was smart enough to realize Google was a big platform. They launched the AdWords product. And literally on the day they launched the AdWords product, I started buying wine terms. At first, wine, Bordeaux, Merlot, Champagne. Later, I had to pick, you know, you had to get smarter because people started figuring it out. But I had about a year there where I was paying 5 cents and then it became 10 cents for every wine term you can imagine and acquiring customers for nothing. Sometimes 20, 30 cents to get customers, active customers, which is insane. So that became, about a couple of years ago, I realized what I've been talking about was underpriced attention, meaning the reason I'm so passionate about LinkedIn now, but didn't say a word about it 6 years ago, is the organic reach on a LinkedIn post for a business right now is meaningful. Because LinkedIn has so much attention on it, yet not as much content and ads on it yet, this is what always happens, you're able to get some organic reach when you post. To me, that is the holy grail of marketing. When you're getting people to know about your business or you, and it costs you less, AKA either zero on organic reach, or why Facebook became so big when you can spend $50 and get people to see it. One of my issues with LinkedIn has been that there's a floor on the CPM, on the cost. There's a $2 floor, not a 5 cent floor. So I want to take advantage of, you know, the long tail of targeting. So every time I see my LinkedIn counterparts in the US working with my media, it's funny. It's like an ongoing joke because I think you can tell by the tone I've had here. I'm such a fan of LinkedIn, but in one very specific place. And I understand why you do it because it's a lack of inventory. So it allows you to create a floor. I understand. But I still like to razz. And every time I walk by a meeting with my media team and the LinkedIn team, I pop my head in. I'm like, have you lowered the floor? And it's become almost this like little meme joke. But that's how I see it, which is for certain things, I do not believe paying $2 per CPM is the right thing. And that's why we are very tactical on LinkedIn. In other arenas, paying $70 CPMs is the right thing. And we're only paying $13 because there's not that much spend against that narrow thing. And that would be an example of me saying, wow, LinkedIn's remarkable. I'm only paying $13 CPMs here to reach this executive class. That's an incredible deal for this company. I'd have to pay, and then when you amortize conversion, I might be paying $13 CPMs, but it might cost me $1,000 to get a customer, whereas it will cost me way more on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube to get that same customer because LinkedIn has so much data around people and their professional career. That's why LinkedIn is an underpriced medium for me. It's media product, it's ad product, has the capabilities of being better than anything else in the world on very specific planning. And then on top of that, it also has organic reach that I don't see from anywhere besides TikTok right now, and obviously two very different audiences. So underpriced attention to me is things like the Super Bowl in America costs $6 million, and I think it's unbelievably underpriced because 100 million people will watch your commercial. Meanwhile, I think a regular commercial on the telly is overpriced, because there's assumptions about GRPs and Nielsen ratings that I just know are not true in common sense. Facebook organic used to be the greatest thing in the world. It doesn't even exist anymore. It's an ad product. Running the ads on Facebook as we do, and we to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, there's a lot of ways to make it underpriced. It's by doing contextual creative at scale and doing 80 different media spends instead of one. There's ways to make it overpriced on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, where you just do one video and you just try to reach everybody 18 to 55. So I spend my life being religious around where's the nook and cranny that allows me to pay 5 cents that is really worth 20 cents on business in a minefield where there's a lot of places you can spend 20 cents and only get 5 cents value. That's what I mean by underpriced attention. I can't hear you, Emma.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now? Is that better?
I can. Yes,
yeah,
it is.
Sorry about that. No, I was just saying that was great. Thank you. So, I mean, you obviously, over the years, you've seen how all the different social platforms have evolved. You've definitely been at the cutting edge. What do you believe is the next big thing for social, or what's coming down the track? What do you think is the next big thing?
You know, it's funny. I don't predict what I'm really great at, Emma, is being the fastest mover when it's become obvious. So, you know, what I've had a great career on is when LinkedIn made that switch, I was there right away. You know, I was one of those first 100 influencers. Of that first 100 influencers, I produced the most content, you know, and so when Musical.ly, the predecessor to TikTok, had some momentum, even though it looked like it was just 12-year-old girls, I was in there making content. So, you know, I don't know what the next TikTok or Facebook or LinkedIn, you know, LinkedIn and TikTok are a lot of fun for me because they're the two leaders of organic, which is always the thing I talk about because a lot of people who follow me have no money. And so when you have no money, you need organic. What's fun about TikTok and LinkedIn is TikTok is the newest of a line of Snapchat, Facebook, Twitter, a true social network for the youth that's growing. LinkedIn's a great one for my thesis of not predicting. I would have never predicted LinkedIn as the next content place. LinkedIn is a story of a pivot, or not a pivot, a very smart addition to an ongoing platform. What that means is one could argue that YouTube tomorrow can say, wait a minute, why don't we just add a stream of content that doesn't have to be video and they might become a more meaningful social network. You would probably more logically argue that that would be a distraction and that's why they haven't done it. Right now there's two, you know, incredible, you know, 16-year-olds in Scotland who might be making the next great app. That's not something I could know about. I'm not Nostradamus. But I can promise you that if that app gets traction, sustained traction, because you do see a lot of apps have a good week or a good month or a good day. And there's an unbelievable amount of names. Peach and Vine even had a very nice run until it was bought. Social Cam, Plurk, Friendster, MySpace. Right? You've got these things that have 1 week, even sometimes 3 year runs. I'm not a predictor, but I'm a practitioner of the moment of the apps that are winning.
I say too. Brilliant. I mean, we look at, you know, you look at social as a whole, and if we pivot now more to VaynerX, you know, it's an absolute juggernaut. How did you navigate the landscape, a landscape dominated by global holding companies?
Patience. You know, we're 10 years in, we're still a $200 million revenue holding co, which is peanuts compared to the Publicis and Omnicoms and things of that nature. But we're emerging, and we're emerging because of underpriced attention. What I mean by that is, in the same way that I do underpriced attention, as a businessman, I look for opportunities that people don't see. And we became the best in the world, no question. And I'm proud to say this, and I know it sounds audacious, but it is very clear to me that there is no agency in the world that is better at understanding how to make content and run media across the 15 apps that dominate the mobile phone: LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter. And I think people are starting to realize, wait a minute, that is where brand is being built. That is not where you're just doing lower funnel conversion. That's actually where brand is being built. And brand is the game. And as the biggest companies in the world say, oh my God, I don't want a TV first approach. I want a social first approach that makes me find what I should put on TV. We've got a loud leader who's got a decade of being historically correct on the content that he's put out, which gives enormous amount of confidence to these decision makers. And not to mention the other thing that I didn't think of, because you don't think about being old when you're young, but you know, in a decade or two here, the majority of CMOs that are going to be making the decisions grew up on my content and my books. And so just, you know, from a brand standpoint, and we're starting to feel it, you know, there's been a couple of moments here in the last year, I'm like, wait a minute, this is cool. The person that actually made that decision, they decided this was right in university when they were reading my book in class. Like, we don't even, like, that was a weird pitch. They were saying my words to me. We didn't even have to convince them. So as the decision maker evolves, you know, what we have the benefit of is that what we've been focused on actually became true. Most of the marketing world dismissed, and continues, to be frank, dismisses social media or content on these platforms as a nice to have. I view it as the singular source of oxygen for businesses going forward. You know, just it you know, you can't worry about anything. You have to start with being an incredible content producer to the relevant cohorts and segments in these channels. And then you can worry about putting your logo on a football, you know, jersey for the Premier League, or running an ad on telly, or doing outdoor billboards in the subway systems. And because you've already figured out the right answer in these channels at very low cost. So we'll see, but I've navigated it by being more right about where the world was going. And it's not because I'm smarter, it's because the holding companies are attached to where the money is right now. They're gonna sell commercials, and because that's where the money is now, because they're publicly traded and they have to make revenue every quarter. I'm building something in perpetuity, which has allowed me to play a different game, and we're starting to feel the benefits of that.
I'm just going to pivot slightly. Just I'm conscious of time, and there's just one kind of area I'd love to get your perspective of. Obviously, we talk about the year we've had. I'd love to hear how you have managed your physical and mental well-being during the pandemic. You know, we were only looking at 2 weeks of offices being closed down, and we ended up going into weeks and then months. So I'd love to get how you managed your physical and mental well-being, and how can we kind of create a culture of getting people to prioritize this for themselves?
You know, for me, it's been about choices. It's recognizing early on that this was not going to be a one-day thing, and being self-aware. This is a self-awareness game, right? To me, I know that I do my best when I am optimistic and when my perspective is proper. So I went into a tunnel vision of, hey, this is a bummer, but in the 1940s, people were running very successful companies, and then the Nazis invaded. So, you know, this stinks, but in the history of time, there's been tougher times. And for me, that always works. For me to lean into gratitude and into worst case scenario, that works for my psyche. I also have had enough success in my career that 6 years ago, I was able to afford a full-time trainer just for me. And that is how I got my health into a much better place. And so I knew that by not him babysitting me, that I was vulnerable. So I had a very quick call with him early on and said, hey, we're going to train virtually on Zoom. You're going to watch me go on the scale every day so I don't lose my way. And so I kind of attacked a strategy early on from a physical and mental place. And I think everybody here needs to do the same. If you know that you binge eat when you're stressed and you don't want to put on 30 pounds during COVID, you need to first acknowledge that truth and then try to find a system that works for you, whether that's asking your spouse to hold you accountable, whether that's creating a Facebook group, whether that's putting out content and holding yourself accountable, whether that's throwing out all the food that's, you know, my mom and I are very similar. We'll eat literally anything in front of us. So if it's a candy bar or if it's green beans, it's all the same. We're just, we call ourselves lawn mowers. I have successfully taken all bad food out of my house. My mom continues to not, and thus she's had a different experience in COVID than I have had. You know, I think it's self-awareness, but then also not overjudging yourself, Emma. I think the reason people struggle is they beat themselves up. And I'd like everybody to have a little more compassion and sympathy for themselves during this time. AKA, if you did gain 15 pounds in this year, it's okay. When we get back to normal and you can go and do what works for you, in the next year you'll lose that. And so enjoy the crack, you know, the candy while you can. So I think it's a balance of strategy and self-love.
Really great advice there as well. I think it's been a tough year for people, so that's really great to hear.
Yeah, it's been a very challenging year. And I think a couple things. One, why should we as humans live lives during all easy times when our grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents didn't? So I think one, the first thing everyone has to do is get over their own audacity and entitlement to like this great, you know, it's not the way it actually works. You have both sides of the coin. I think once you get over that, if you don't beat yourself up for not, you know, a lot of people are beating themselves up because they didn't save money, even though they knew it was the right thing to do. They didn't because they wanted to live a certain lifestyle and now they are in a pickle. What many will do in that scenario is start to really be upset with themselves. You should have a self-reflection moment, but you can't go into a time machine and change the fact that you went on vacations you couldn't afford and buy clothes you couldn't afford. So you're not going to be able to do that. What you can do is make a commitment to yourself to going forward, acting in a different way. And I hope that people learn about themselves during this time.
We're nearly ready for Q&A, but I just wanted to ask you just one question. Well, what is the question that you're never asked in these discussions that you wish you were asked?
You know, I think this is a very interesting answer. When I sign up for these, I'm 100% focused on bringing value to the audience. So I don't have any wishes on questions. The only question I wish people ask is if they actually have a question, but they're scared to ask it because they think it would offend me or I wouldn't know the answer, or who knows what would be the rationale. I'm here to service in this setting. So I don't have any real feelings towards a question I want to be asked. I just want to answer the question that everybody wants to be asked.
To be honest. Look, with that, what we'll do is we're actually going to bring Niall back on screen because we thought it'd be great to have him involved. And he's been moderating the Q&A. So Niall, I'm going to let you take over the questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Emma. Hey, Gary. Hey again.
Hello, good to see you, friend. It's always great to see you.
It's been a while. Listen, we got some awesome questions through for you across a few different channels. So we should be able to get through them in about 13 minutes. So, I'll just get started here. The first question comes in from someone on my team, Erin McIver, and it's about sports cards. I think you might know about. It's around really about the with the rise of online platforms. Do you, such as Panini Blockchain, do you see that the sports card industry will become predominantly a virtual offering in the future? And if so, how will this impact trading value of existing physical cards?
I don't think so, at least in, let's say, the next half century. Do I think something can lose its value as a physical item in all shapes and form? Of course I do. I just think it's too early for, like, blockchain is an unbelievable technology, and I think will have incredible ramifications on society over the next century. But do I think that everything gets tokenized as quickly as a lot of blockchain enthusiasts think? The answer is no. And the reason I say that is look how far along we are in the last half decade. I mean, blockchain has been very prominent for the last half decade, and we still don't have anywhere close to the amount of innovation on it that I think many of us thought could be the case 5 years ago. And so I think that the tokenization of sports cards and art and many other things will happen. I think that there'll be some moments of things popping, kind of similar to the way that augmented reality technology is incredibly strong right now in the world. Yet we've only had Pokemon Go be a real phenomenon in the AR world. So do I think, Niall, that something can come along and get tokenized and do really well? Yes, but you know, for example, and you know this about me, Niall, I don't talk about or do things that I don't believe in. If I thought that trading cards and football stickers, which would be more European, would lose its value, I wouldn't be buying Mbappe, you know, rookie cards for $5,000 a piece. Why? To watch it go down in value? So I don't think in the short term there's going to be that level of traction. I think people underestimate human behavior. Here's what I mean by that. Online dating, in the mid-90s, I told all my friends that all of them would be doing online dating if they didn't get married before online dating. And when I tell you everybody made fun of me for saying that, they made fun of me because at the time in 1996, online dating was very creepy and was really, when you thought about online dating, the image you thought about was a 600-pound guy in his mom's basement. Well, now, as we all know, online dating is foundational to all youth, all everyone for that matter. I feel the same way about physical things. I think that people think everything's gonna go on blockchain, and it will. But even though online dating is massive across the world, there is a stunning amount of people who do not do it and still go to the pub or get introduced to their sister. And I think, Niall, that's what will happen in 40 years with sports cards and other tangible goods. I think there'll be an absolute world of tokenization and blockchain, but I don't think that will take away from people. And I would argue that it might even enhance the value of the most rare physical items. You know, it's what we see now. We've already seen in our young lives, everybody here, the growth and creation of social networks, the slow but steady curve of people spending time on it, and now the apex moments of it, so much so that kids, predominantly in their teens, are taking week or month breaks from it because they're the counterculture to it. Much like the rise of blockchain will absolutely create tokenization of items, and then you'll see people want to own the physical card because everything went digital, no different than hipsters in Brooklyn wanting to own pagers and flip phones instead of the iPhone. The human race likes to swing pendulums, and over the next century will swing to the digitalization of physical goods only to then be countered with people going backwards into physical goods, just like what's happening with food habits. I hope everybody understands what's happening with food in the world. People are starting to eat clean the way that people ate 150 years ago. We then had the rise of modern food and business and technology create all the things we known, and now people are trying to go back to just ingredients and clean eating. So that's just how humans work.
Awesome, thanks, Gary. Next question, for anyone, I'm going through the Q&A in liked first. You mentioned the key to success is not really caring too much about what other people think. How do you get yourself into the mindset to be able to kick through any doors or people who have said you can't do something? This is from Steve O'Brien.
You know, Steve, I think for me, it was a journey of losing a lot as a child. You know, I was an immigrant. I didn't speak the language, so it was hard for me to, you know, make friends when I first got to America. Then I was a bad student, so all my teachers said, no, you're a failure, bad, push against. I wasn't, you know, after about third or fourth grade, it was clear to me that I was not remarkable at sports. So there wasn't that thing that a lot of kids rely on. So I basically lived a life with a lot of adversity and a lot of no. You know, my parents didn't buy me things. Mom, I want Nintendo. No. You know, like my life was about no. And so it was very easy once I became an adult to be comfortable in no. For a lot of you, my children included, no was, you were in the business of yes, you know, and in that became the vulnerability because no seemed scary, foreign. So I think the biggest way for you or anybody else at a more advanced age of not being a child anymore is getting into the practice of losing and doing no's. Trying things that are hard to you, doing things that require no. You people need to have a relationship with no, and that is only something that either you are serendipitously growing up with and or something that you manufacture for yourself when you get older by putting yourself in uncomfortable positions so that you become more comfortable with rejection. It's ironic you asked that question. Literally, my Instagram post that I snuck in while I was doing the interview with Emma, because I multitask, you might have saw me looking down at some point. Literally, this post that I just posted is that people are too addicted to positive reinforcement. You're smart. You're pretty. That's awesome. once you believe that, you become susceptible to negative reinforcement. So Niall, the reason I'm able to deal with pushback and no is actually when Emma introduces me and says all those nice things, I don't believe them. I don't know how else to say it. When I hear that I'm a 5-time New York Times bestseller, that's funny to me because I failed all my English and writing classes. When I hear, you know, when Emma says something like, you've actually made a dent in this global advertising, you know, you know this, Niall, you were with us very early on. That's funny. We were like a ragtag group of 50 people that just were sitting in an office, right? You know this. So for me, I don't get high on my accomplishments, which allows me to not get low on when I'm dealing with negativity. I just keep it very zen, very in the middle. Like, I'm aware of what I've got going on and where it's going. And I'm also aware that I'm 44 years old, which means I have a lot of time to build on this. And it can end up being in a very crazy place, not financially, on impact. I'm well known at this point and I'm just starting. So I know that kind of, God willing, with health and all that, you know, my destiny at some level is for some pretty big bridges, but that will never make me think that I'm better than somebody or I'm greater than, which allows me to then deal with the negativity that comes along with that much notoriety. And I like that. I like that I don't get too high and I don't get too low.
Awesome. Great answer. All right. Next question, shifting gears ever so slightly.
Real quick, because I think you'll understand this. It also lends itself, because that's important, because it's meta. It also lends itself to humility. You know, the reason I don't struggle with other people's feedback is because I'm actually humble. Humble enough that when a former employee like yourself reaches out to me and says, this is important to me, that even though I do not have time, I have negative time. I right this minute can live the rest of my 50 years and not accomplish everything that is in front of me right now. Yet, I have the humility and the empathy, compassion, and love to say yes to you because I'm hoping it helps you, right? So if you can have humility and generosity, it actually makes you less susceptible to negativity.
That's awesome. And I can attest to that. Anytime I've emailed you, you're back within the hour. It's really impressive. It's incredible.
LinkedIn is huge. It's a very important platform for me, but there is 0.0 chance I'm doing this talk without you. And I think that being in that place as a human, basically what I'm telling everybody is no matter what level of success you have, please remember that you're insignificant. That may sound harsh. It's actually an incredibly liberating, exciting experience. I'm doing a lot out here, and I know that if I die tomorrow, I'll have a couple of hours on social networks where I get a lot of love, where people maybe will share their favorite story of me, or you'll write Niall on your LinkedIn, he was always there for me and replied in an hour, or somebody will share their favorite clip. But in truth, in 72 hours, everybody has to go back to their normal lives. And outside of a group of 25 to 50 people, that's it. And I think if you can live in that humility, it allows you to deal with the ability. It gets very hard, if you believe what I just said, to get too down when anonymous leaves a comment on your LinkedIn post that you suck. It's hard to like let that carry too much weight when you understand what I just said. Let's sneak in two more before I get out of here.
All right, next question.
Sneak in another one, that would be great.
So next question is, if you could add one thing to LinkedIn streaming, what would it be and why? And this is coming from Gavin Roberts on our group.
It's a little tweak on what you have now. Right now, live streaming from a mobile device is too clunky with third-party providers. I think LinkedIn is built for more live experiences, but right now the creator side on the app side is not strong. And if that can be fixed, I think you'll have even more engagement and more incredible content. LinkedIn is the place for meaningful conversations, for TED Talk-like conversations in live format, but it's just not there yet as a product.
Awesome. And my chat is blowing up right now from the team saying that we are in beta for that. So you've gotten their attention. Okay, last question before we wrap this up. And let's say we'll leave it a good question. What's the most impressive brand you've worked with and why?
I would say currently it's Procter & Gamble's Olay in the US and ironically SK-II Procter & Gamble in Singapore office. Because they've given us the freedom to find the creative right instead of being right. So 99% of marketing behavior today is a strategist and a creative on an agency side come up with a hypothesis, try to sell it into a client, and then the client spends all its money hoping that that messaging was right, which is asinine. What we've been able to do on Olay in the US and SK-II in Asia is produce an enormous amount of content across 50 different hypotheses, see what actually is resonating with computers, and then ladder up the creative. I believe that will be the creative format of the next century. And I believe that there are very few people that have the humility and the lack of fear to go with that model in corporate life. And I think it's the courage of the leaders on those pieces of businesses that have created that opportunity.
Great. And should we wrap it up there? And Emma, take it away.
Thanks, Noel. Great to see you there.
Thank you so much for your time today. It was really great. We really appreciate it. We know how busy you are. So we really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us today. And hopefully we'll get to talk to you again soon.
Bye, everyone. I'm very available on LinkedIn to say hello. So if you had a good time, send me a message. I'd love to say hi to some of you. Take care.
Bye, Gary.
Thanks, Gary.
All right, episode's over. Please leave a review and subscribe up on Apple. It would mean a lot to me. Thank you very much.
Hey, podcast. Joe from Team Gary here. Today's highlighted review is Gary V is My B School by FAP. Listening to Gary V has been pivotal in giving me the motivation and knowledge to grow my business, flipping home goods on social media. I went from 1 to 2K to over 5K in sales last month. And I'm having so much fun. I'm so glad I didn't spend all that money and time to go to B-School because listening to this podcast and learning from this experience has been everything. Thanks, Gary. Keep those reviews coming. We could highlight yours next.